Okay, good evening, everyone. I wanted to tonight I thought sharing with you the workshop I did last weekend. Roshi was actually present. It was in Dana, and it was a workshop. Sesshin, a retreat on calligraphy and meditation. And it was led by someone called Ming, who is a calligraphy master and a Zen practitioner, and he received his calligraphy transmission from Kaz Ta-Nehisi, who is a well-known calligraphy master and also a Zen master, I think, in the Suzuki lineage. And it was very interesting. And a couple of things that I'd love to share with you tonight, and maybe that will resonate. And I think it's very relevant for our practice. And as you know, I was actually thinking how all the various Buddhist traditions have incorporated, and all actually spiritual or in religious traditions have always incorporated creative and artistic practices. And maybe the way art and creativity is approached tells something about the tradition itself. And so when Buddhism reached China, that art of calligraphy, I assume, was already present. And it was really being taken by Zen teachers as a, I don't know if it's complementary or additional or just another tool to express and to deepen the practice. And we could think also about about other artistic processes like poetry. And I guess in with Welfare, with we are rather sensitive about the creative process. Amy being a writer, and a lot of us have artistic practices, whether it's singing or writing or painting, sewing. My personally my only background in calligraphy was what we did years ago with Roshi, calligraphy workshops, which she's not a calligraphy master, but she had taken some classes at Naropa in Colorado, and with the Dharma, about Dharma art. And so she was approaching in a very, I don't know if you, some of you, Elisa was there. We had basic brush and basic water painting. You were not there, Lisa? No, you've never done that. But Debbie was there, I think. We did when we did the calligraphy thing with Roshi in at the center here in Paris. Were
I
you had
don't
you
think
done
I've,
that?
no, I think I've never done it.
Okay, okay. Well, okay. So I was the only one. So, but at some point she did that. I think she did that twice, I think. Anyway, that was my knowledge about calligraphy is extremely limited. I'm not a painter. I don't really paint, though. It has always been a fantasy of mine to paint. But because I already have music, it's I can't take another another artistic endeavor. So we started so that it's we started on, when was it? Was it only Friday night that we started? I don't know. The whole thing seemed like very long, actually. Yeah, it started on Friday night. And so after a period of sitting, he introduced us with the tools. He had brought tons of A4 classic sheets of paper, and we had brushes, proper this time, proper calligraphy brushes, rather simple, rather basic, and an ink, black ink. And basically for the first few hours until and the whole basically the whole Saturday, we started to do basic strokes. And apparently what he said, what Ming explained, is that there are five, eight basic strokes. That's all. To do all the signs in the Chinese calligraphy, there's only eight basic strokes that you need to learn. And combined, you do all the characters with just eight basic strokes. And so we started by just doing points first, and then lines, vertical lines, and then horizontal lines. And so it was just like on and on and on, doing dots and dots and strokes and vertical lines. And I was very bored, I have to admit. I was quite bored. And one of the things that I realized I've been missing this year, which because of all kinds of reasons in my life, I was lacking a little bit of, I'm lacking a little bit of fun, and I didn't take a lot of time to develop my creativity. And I thought, well, originally I thought, oh, this workshop might bring me there, and I was just doing lines, and I wasn't very pleased. I was very bored. It was nice, and I could also really just see. I was not bored in the sense of, I mean, I could see the how contemplative that was, just to do like we do in meditation. It's like breathing in, breathing out, and just doing a stroke. It was very contemplative. Not fun, kind of enjoyable, maybe. Brought some calm, but I wouldn't say it was fun. So I was a little bit disappointed. And strangely enough, and that feeling was shared by many people afterwards once we talked about it on Saturday evening, Saturday night, Saturday at lunchtime. I was exhausted on Friday night, even after 2 hours doing that. And on Saturday, I was just exhausted. And really, I wasn't the only one. And then something, so there were like various stages. The first stage is to learn these eight basic strokes. You combine them, and then once we had seen the eight basic strokes, we started to combine them into characters, these Chinese characters, Chinese, Japanese characters. And then there was the traditional character, and then there was cursive and semi-cursive. So basically, it starts like really just basically imagine, I mean, if I had to take a metaphor, you know, the basic one would be like a square. And then it becomes like something more roundish. And then it really, the semi-cursive is really just lines. It's getting wild. So we started with a square, then we moved to the semi-cursive, gave us a little bit more freedom, and then it started to become a little bit more wild with a cursive. So that was really like a process of learning the stuff and learning the basic stuff to learning something that was becoming more wild. And on, when was it? On Saturday evening, at some point, he said, "Now, we've learned the strokes, we've learned the things, and you've experienced the characters, and you've experienced the traditional form, the cursive and semi-cursive. But, we can really do it. You can really do it your own way." And then he took the, whereas before we were like, he was really teaching us how to put the brush in the ink very slowly, gently remove the excess ink on the brush and all that. And then he showed us, and he's like, he took the brush and just crashed the brush on the sheet, and then you can just, go for it. And suddenly I was like relieved. And there was something that totally kind of changed. And we could really experiment something. And he said, "You have the characters, but you can take parts of it, only parts of it. And look at that." And so he was showing he had a book from Kastanahashi, this great calligraphy master. And he was And on each page, you had a character, the traditional form, cursive, semi-cursive, and Kastanahashi's interpretation. And then Kastanahashi's interpretation was totally wild. And the character for the wind, for example, that just became on with his interpretation was just like a brush that just looked like wind, not even a character. So that was like a, for me, like a turning point. And whereas for some, as we talked afterwards, when we did a circle at the end, for some, they said, "Well, actually, I could have stayed on the first stage, just doing the strokes, basic strokes." Yeah. They had enough with that. I felt a little bit tight just doing the strokes. Whereas when he said, doing the other things, felt more free. And what I kept thinking of was the parallel that process evoked in me was really just me when I practice music and I practice my scales. And sometimes when I just end up practicing only the only thing I end up doing is scales, and I'm thinking, this is not fun. I'm not really playing music. I'm just practicing my scales. And I stay on that exact same stage of just the learning the basic strokes, learning the scales. And then on Saturday, on Sunday, which was the last day, where after we've used, it was insane how many sheets of paper we each of us used, like A4 paper. And then he brought out some really fancy rice paper. We had 5 sheets of A4 rice paper, 5 sheets each of a long rice paper. And then 2 squares that was like a thicker paper, really, really nice, and we had 2 each. And he said, "Now you're gonna do your masterpiece." And at that word, I froze. I was panicked. I was really panicked. It was like suddenly it was like, now you have this fancy stuff. It needs to be perfect. In my head, it was like, oh my God, what if I fail? So again, it was so interesting to see that process going on in me. And on top of it, not only was like, we have a limited number of sheets of paper, so it better be good. This is what I was thinking. But on top of it, I had to decide what I would write on this. And suddenly I was panicked. I was like, what am I going to do? I had no inspiration. I had no particular, because the characters that we first started to study was like tree, human, what else? So we had like, but we had also a whole book, and we could ask him, you know, I'd like to do this character. I feel compelled to do this character, or I'd like to do my name. You know, I'd like to write my name. We were spread in Dana. We were spread on three tables, and Yuri Maizumi was on my table, and Yuri started to write his own name. And he said, like, he has no connection with, he doesn't speak Japanese, and for him it was very strong to write Maizumi in Japanese. I didn't feel very compelled to write my name in Japanese or in Chinese, or so I really didn't know. And I was, for a moment, I was just wanted to stop. I sat there and just really not knowing what to do. So, and there was this the sort of definitive this drawing, that's this calligraphy that we're about to do, that would be kind of, this is all set, and just this is, we have 10 to do, was very, yeah, very, very frightening, very and I don't know, I sat there for a moment, really, really not knowing what to do, really, what not knowing what to do. And then I thought, okay, let's try something. And so I looked at the book, and there was the character of mindfulness, and it's composed of something, some parts of it means now. And I thought, oh, that's kind of nice. It looks cool, and it looks like a little mountain. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to work on now. That seems right now, just now. So I started to write now. And because I'm building this Zen refuge sangha, I thought, well, taking refuge is really meaningful to me. So I asked how to do that, Zen ref taking refuge. So then I did taking refuge, and I did several character for now. And then suddenly I had an idea, and it was, and as I was doing that, I felt very suddenly kind of the creative process was really unfolding, and I got really excited. I got really excited with just putting the brush and just crashing the brush and just doing big strokes, and not doing this very elegant and tidy lines and vertical lines and dots, but I was really just really having fun, just doing the strokes and going wild. And I could see how relevant that practice is, that calligraphy practice is, in terms of the qualities we're trying to bring in meditation. Just like, there's just one stroke, and this is it, and not being scared to just, and this is the moment. How do you judge? And forget about judging. Forget about judging if it's a masterpiece or not a masterpiece. Just daring to be in the moment and not knowing what you're going to expect, because it's absolutely unpredictable how the brush is going to end up on the sheet of paper. On top of it, the quality of the rice paper is so different than from the traditional paper that in the beginning where they said, oh, you need to put more ink because it absorbs more, so you have absolutely no idea how it's going to react. So the paper, you don't know how you crush it, you don't know the results. And I was thinking about that this morning, how in the way painting has been practiced for centuries in the Western world, it's never one single brush. We go back to it, and there are layers and layers and layers, and we go back and all that. Whereas there's something very distinct about the way Zen masters used calligraphy. It's just one stroke. This is it. This is it. What you do is what you get. You don't go back to it. You don't try to correct anything. So this is very much our practice. And once I had done several now, something kind of funny happened in my mind. I asked Ming, I said, how do you do the character what? So he seemed hesitant for a moment, and then he showed me. And then I, on a different sheet, I wrote what? And so that made what now? What now? But also, what do we do now? And also I was thinking, what now? What now? What do we do now? Once, so this is this was a very exciting this was a very exciting experience of doing that. So and also he no one said anything about it, but when I left Dana on Friday night, and when I left Dana on Saturday night going home, everyone was had massive piles of A4 sheets full of dots and lines and characters and all that. And I thought to myself, what are we going to do with that? I'm not going to put that on the wall or anything. So I took everything, and I just before entering the subway, I threw everything away. And I thought, well, maybe on Sunday. I didn't know how the workshop would end, but I maybe he would they would he would ask, or I don't know what would happen, they would say. But I thought, what am I going to do with all that? So it reminded me of of someone that I knew who used to write every morning, and as soon as she had finished, she would throw everything away. It felt like very, felt, yeah, I don't know, it felt right that it had no, it was just practice. I shouldn't be attached to it. Though on Sunday, when we had our nice rice paper sheets with our calligraphy that we had done, I took them everything away. I brought them all with me, and then I showed them to Delphine, and then she's like, yeah, well, this one is good. This one you can throw away. And I was like, no, I don't want to throw it away. But what am I going to do with it? So it was very interesting, the various phases, very inspiring to see this also this connection with and to highlight the creative process, that there is in our practice that we can or that can be manifested in a creative process. And that also reminded me of the kind of epitome of the Eightfold Path, according to Stephen Batchelor, which is finding your true voice, expressing, being able to express ourselves freely, unattached, to what it will look like, whether it's beautiful or not, our judgments about it, and just doing it and unleashing our creative, our creative mind. And I think hearing what everyone else went through, all the other participants went through, it was really like an intense process of an intense internal process, psychological process, where people experienced all kinds of things, and about like the relationship. A lot of people wrote their names, tried to write their names in Japanese and or in Chinese, and yeah, this thing about your preference, in terms of cursive, semi-cursive, or some people, as I said, I would have been okay with just staying with doing straight lines, keeping doing straight lines. It reminded me also, I've been thinking about that movie a lot recently. This is really this old movies from the 19, maybe late 1980s or maybe early 1990s, Karate Kid. Whereas in the first Karate Kid movie, this young kid from high school, he's bullied by his friends, and there's next to him there's a Chinese master that is a karate teacher, and so he's th this J Chinese guy starts to teach him karate, or says that he's going to teach him karate, but as a task, he gives him how do you call that? The palisade? His palisade? He's a what's that? Palisade, the how do you call that?
Fence.
Well, yeah, the fence. The wooden fence outside his house. And so the kid starts to spend days and days just painting that. And he's like, I'm not learning karate. I'm just learning how to paint. This is crap. So he starts to be really upset until he realizes that he's actually learning the movement, like the karate movement of moving his hand up and down. So that reminded me, doing these lines, and you do like, why am I doing that? And then you do that in order to free yourself, and then to be able to express yourself. As learning scales is not really fun, but that allows you at some point enough to. I know that at some point I'm not even thinking about the scales if I want to be creative. But it's somewhere. It's somewhere there. The better I know the scales, and the more I let go of the scales, the more freedom and the more musicality there is. So, yeah, and so I'm not necessarily going to pursue calligraphy, but it was resonating a lot with my music practice, with my creative practice, and it seems that it always follows the same kind of process. In order to write, you need to know a little bit of about the grammar, but in order to move towards poetry, or in order to express yourself, we need to you need you may need to getting a little bit loose with the grammar and with the way you use words, and same thing with music, and same thing with whatever you do, with whatever we practice, whatever our artistic practice is, or creative practice is. So that's my account of of this retreat, which was very interesting.
Can I? I was thinking that it's very similar when we do in meditation counting the breath or just get beyond the boring and we are in concentration to so that we can stabilize in open awareness and. It's similar in a different way, of course. And what you mentioned in dropping things away, the whatever, the now, the names, whatever, remind me of because of something that it was really interesting that you said at the beginning. The form that how the artistic way of how do you say our hearts reveals in some sense the way of a tradition. You didn't said this, but something like it, I found it interesting and how these approaches in Buddhism, like in calligraphy in Japan, or I was thinking in Tibetan, there is this practice of the mandala that you are very meticulous putting things, you know, just and at some point you can stay there for. Quite a long time, and at the end, you just offer it in, you know, it's yeah, it's the same processes, and reveal something about the art reveals something about the tradition, what the final points of the what's there, the philosophy or the way or whatever, yeah.
It's true. It's true that the practice we, when people enter for the first time, and I see a lot of newcomers in the institutions where I work, and I give the breath practice and all that. But I also feel that we need to be, if we kind of, in a way, it's a creative process. I mean, we can be creative in the way we practice, and I really encourage. I'm really trying myself to find personal practices, being creative in the way I practice, because depending on the conditions, because depending on the life I'm leading, depending on where I am and all that, and finding creative ways to practice, and in that, I'm also, I feel by doing that, I think we are very faithful to the tradition also, in the sense that Buddhism has evolved tremendously depending on the where it landed, and depending on the people, depending on the, and there's always a risk to think that it's what seems to have do you say, Debbie, do you say coalesce? Coalesce? Just like concentrate?
Well,
Some.
concentrate is better. I don't think coalesce exists.
Okay.
Concentrate
Co
is.
concentrate. Concentrate. And th that is like the definitive thing, that would be, I think, a mistake. And I'm also thinking, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, I'm thinking, for example, of the order, the way the Eightfold Path is set, and I feel it's wonderful what Stephen Batchelor offers by trying to reshape this and reshape the order and thinking and saying, well, you know, the fact that it starts it ends with contemplative practices. This is perfect when you speak to monks, but when you speak to lay people, maybe it should end to something very practical, something more in your daily life. And contemplative practice is more like the groundwork, or and from which we act. So, yeah, and what you said also reminds me of, yeah, in the Tibetan tradition, what you mentioned the mandala, and it's like the fact that it's in sand, you know, they do it in sand. And I mean, I remember when I did a retreat with the Tibetans with Dalai Lama, and it's like they had like, created this huge mandala, and after, and I was like, so much work. And as you said, very precise and very da, 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 putting all the sand, and at the end of the week, gone. Gone. And it's, there's something almost heartbreaking, but at the same time, yeah, there's a point to it. There is a point in this practice of I'm making something beautiful, and now it's gone with the wind. Yeah, and that's really, that tells something about the tradition also, the teaching behind it.
And I was thinking that when you mentioned the now, it reminded me of, well, this thing of the practice being creative at the same time. And it reminded me when you said the you were writing the now, and what now? What now? It's like a koan,
Yeah.
where you can stay creatively in the process of being there, asking this,
Yeah.
what now? What's this?
Yeah, for me it's a big question. What now? What now? It's really yeah, it's for me this is a big one right now. Yeah.
Can I? So thank you, Dua Sensei, for your share with us this experience. I cannot imagine you bored. It's very hard for me imagine you bored, being bored, because you are always very enthusiastic about things. Anyway, what you said reminds me different situations. I had a friend, he already died. He was a painter and an architect also. And once he traveled to China, and he tried, he realized that especially on weekends, people used to go out and do calligraphy in the open, but with water, just water. That means that it will be all gone after a while. With the wind, it will dry and nothing remains there. But there was he told me that he was very how do you say, he was very surprised and impressed with this crowd of people in some places, you know, doing calligraphy with water. A very ephemeral practice. But this practice, he touched him so much that when he came back, he never stopped to try. He didn't know nothing, but he got the rice paper, he got the black ink, and he did a lot of experiments in calligraphy. So this was one story that I I remember. And also, I was looking for the name of a book that I read some time ago about a French girl that went to China, and she gave her life for calligraphy, you know, years and years and years, and she worked with the best. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Fabienne Verbier.
Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Fabienne Verbier actually went after on Sunday afternoon. They have a big exhibition right now of her work.
Yes.
It's quite beautiful. Yeah.
It is.
Fabienne
Yeah.
Verdier, her name is. Yeah.
Yeah. And she really gave her life for that, you know. She it was her life, the calligraphy, and she had huge brushes and little ones and everything. And yeah, thank you.
Her work is quite beautiful. It's actually Ming said, he said at some point to us, you know, it's very imp I'm very excited to be in France. I mean, this is the land of Fabienne Verbier. She's one of the best coming
Yeah.
from like this Chinese American calligraphy master. That was quite funny.
Is she alive?
Yeah, she's alive.
Yeah.
She's alive, and so there's a big exhibition right now in Paris. But it's funny because she doesn't do any of the characters, like the traditional characters. So, but she uses the calligraphy technique, and now she's moving slightly away. There are like certain pieces that are a little bit that where she actually moves away from the calligraphy technique to do other things, but it's still the yeah. And she has these huge in her studio. She has these huge brushes that are hung from
Yes.
the ceiling, which is like
Yeah.
moving the yeah. It's there's something very yeah, liberating, like Jackson Pollock. I could imagine Jackson Pollock having really, really fun, like the
Yeah.
freedom of just, you know, splashing some paint on a big canvas.
And do you know more about this practice with water?
No,
In
no,
China,
no, no.
it looks like it is very common, you know, for common people. Just go and
And then when you say water, do you mean watercolors or just water, like out
water,
how does it work?
water. You go. You draw the calligraphy, and it's gone. It's gone. It's gone. It's gone.
And also, you know, I would as you were talking, also, I'm thinking of how creative, for some reason, that sort of came out. I don't know how it actually came out, but like when we're singing the vows in the morning, you know, it became wilder and wilder. We started mixing languages, and then Dale started to kind of on, you know, move the pitch from one line to the next, and so we learn the grammar, and then we can just really move freely and try to embody it and express it. And I think it's very, there's something very deep in this process.
Were you really bored, Sensei?
Yeah, I wasn't. I would say I was not having fun, and I was just like, it's not that I was bored. It's true that I'm hardly ever bored, but I really wanted to have some fun, and I wasn't finding the fun. I was finding a very contemplative process. You know, it was like sitting, you know, and I was like, yeah, but I want something else. Yeah, Debbie.
Well, first of all, it's coalesce. I looked it up. It does exist and it can be used that way.
Okay.
But what I really wanted to ask you, and thank you for describing this thing that I missed. I had two lessons that I had promised to help these people on the weekend, and they both canceled. So I was quite annoyed that I missed the whole thing. So it was nice to have a compte rendu. When you say you work on different practices, do you mind giving us examples? Because sometimes I feel kind of funny about branching out. I don't want to get myself out in some hippy dippy thing that doesn't really have anything to do with anything.
Well, God, I could give you a list of 100 practices, you know. I mean, that goes from, I mean, if I'm thinking about the formal practice as I'm sitting, you know, it can be follow the breath, but could also sit with a particular question that I'm struggling with. Can be a koan. Also, recently I've started to just for the fun of it and to look at other koans, you know, from other collections that I haven't studied and to get inspired and not just to, you know, sit just like that with a breath and whatever is coming up. So that's one, you know, that's one aspect, the formal practice and actually I've been forced, kind of been forced to or was asked to recently in the one of the institution that I work at INSEAD to come up with themes every week, different themes. So last this week it was fear, for example. So working with fear.
I've been there.
Yeah. So another time it was authenticity and true voice, and another time it was anxiety, another time it was like fear of failure or something like that, you know, like, and so being creative in the sense of I'm going to take a theme, I'm going to take a I'm going to take something that might be relevant for people or that is relevant for me, and I'm going to contemplate this. That's being creative. Or that could be doing a Tonglen, a loving kindness practice, you know, depending on what I feel I should develop. That's one thing in terms of formal practice, but I also feel, if we are, I don't know, okay, if I take my music practice, I realize, you know, I can be totally bored and it can be totally non-creative and I could be totally stuck, or I could take the music practice and bring the same kind of intentions and the same kind of focus that I have with a formal practice. Meaning, let's just see what comes up. Let's not cling on results and, you know, that bring these type of qualities. If I cook, you know, how do I approach cooking? Do I approach cooking from a, you know, thinking it needs to be the best thing, or I don't have that ingredient, therefore, you know, all these things that Bernie talked about, and so, you know, that again, using everything that I have at hand and bring the qualities and just invent something out of it. I was like, I have problems in. If, for example, I have problems approaching my work from the point of view of a Samu, you know, so what could help me to do that? Well, maybe just when I have to do something that I really hate doing, like my pay my taxes, can I think of it as this is my Samu time? So I'm putting an incense stick and I'm just going to do it with, you know, fully and just, you know. Yesterday I was struggling because I was in the middle of doing things, and then I was called by my daughter-in-law because she needed help because of the kids and her kid and my granddaughter and the dog, and it was too much, and I had to stop everything. I was like a little bit, she's really just, I really had problems to let go of that and just, all right, let's just do it and fully, with all my heart. And I had to, it was a little bit, and then I had to take care, I had to take care of the food, and it took me 4 hours in my day, which was like half of my day, basically. It was really kind of at the same time annoying, and at the same time, can I approach it from a different angle, from an action of loving kindness, and from a point of view of letting go of something,
Okay, but when from I hear what you're saying, and I've been kind of working at the same thing, only it's not my daughter-in-law, it's my frigging cat. Never sees me in the kitchen without having to drink out of the faucet. So I watched this and I thought, okay, but Debbie, this is no big deal for crying out loud. How do you switch the, I mean, I'm trying to, instead of saying, oh, not now, damn it, say, oh, well, I'm so happy to serve you, but I'm faking. It's a fake. So in the beginning, when you're saying, oh, okay, I'm going to do this, you're with pleasure, you're lying or you're faking it. So how do you make it, really feel like, I mean, I forget about the cat, but you know what I mean.
Well, sometimes I don't manage, frankly. Sometimes I don't manage. Sometimes what I do feel help is, and that is really, that's the practice that helps, the formal practice that helps, the sitting practice that helps, to step back and recognize, just recognize, this is fucking up my old day, basically. I'm not happy about it, and just really recognizing it, trying to get the sense of clarity also, I feel, might help, like a clarity about, sometimes I have to say no, and that's okay also. And some people may not be happy about it, but that also okay. So there's a right balance to find, but there's something about recognizing, acknowledging, yes, I also wonder, sometimes I wonder about this thing about fake it until you make it, as we say. I really wonder, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. I feel, and I'm not sure how to answer that. It's like, yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. Sometimes, if we fake and we don't manage to make it, well,
It's faking.
maybe at some point we should just stop faking it and just recognizing and go back to our cushion and see. And it's like, what is it that I'm actually clinging to? What is the thing that resists? And that's where a contemplative practice is absolutely essential. Just really, as we say, staying with it, staying with it, really just step back and seeing if we have the luxury to do so. Sometimes we don't have the luxury to step back because we have to respond right in the moment. But our contemplative training helps us to be better at it, stepping back and being quicker at noticing our clinging. This is what I feel for me. Becoming quicker at noticing where we cling because of our contemplative practice.
And it does help. I mean, it really does change things. When I got to the stand, they announced 38 minutes for the bus to come, which ruined my whole plan of getting here on and sitting and everything. And I'm working on this. So I thought, don't sit here for 38 minutes, Debbie, and say, hur. But the guy next to me, which not does not have the Zazen practice to help him, so he did it for me the whole time. Okay, I made a promise not to bitch, but what about you? Can't you? So I mean, I find it preferable to bitching.
Yeah.
But it's not very authentic, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are almost at the end of our time.
Well, thank you so much for listening and sharing. Very nice.
Thank you.
Thank you.